Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine today takes us to the Cross Insurance Center in Bangor. This past October, the Maine Chamber of Commerce honored Maine's five living United States senators. This program can be heard on our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast.
Now it is my pleasure to welcome our distinguished guests of honor to the stage. Needing no introduction, please say hello to Secretary Bill Cohen, Senator George Mitchell, Senator Olympia Snow, Senator Susan Collins, and Senator Angus King.
Well, I just want to start out by saying I always get a glow inside when I'm asked to do events like this, because I remember the beginning of my career when I was a kid. I got out of college, I was a young reporter, covered my first campaign, presidential campaign in 1984. Ronald Reagan was running for re-election. So cool, fly around on Air Force One and the press plane. One day we got a notice that said we were going to a black tie fundraiser in Los Angeles with the president. And at that time in my life, I think I only owned one dark suit, so I packed the dark suit and went out to Los Angeles, and it was all these Hollywood and wealthy business people and just big cheeses walking around in tuxedos, and I thought it was really cool to be part of it. Go in the restroom at one point, and I'm washing my hands, and I grab a towel from the dispenser. Guy in a tux walks in and says, no thank you. Now I've had my emails hacked by WikiLeaks or the Russian government, and as a result of emails asking John Podesta to lunch and congratulating him on winning primaries, I had the experience last week of being attacked within 24 hours by Donald Trump, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Bill O'Reilly. You guys probably never had that happen to you. Have you ever been attacked like that?
No.
Okay. But seriously, it's a privilege to do this because you do have an extraordinary set of public servants who've represented you, and represented you in ways that are increasingly rare in Washington. And we've had a lot of attention to the fact that Washington doesn't function particularly well right now. That's been dramatized by events of the last few years, but it really goes back further than that. As a matter of fact, before coming up for this event, I was reading the farewell address that Senator Cohen wrote. By the way, Secretary Cohen or Senator Cohen?
Your Majesty.
I noticed people calling you Secretary Cohen. Does that mean that you outrank all of these, including the former Majority Leader of the United States?
It depends on which audience you're in front of. If you're with senators, it's Senator. If you're with the Executive Branch, it's Secretary. Now that we're here, it's just Bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when Senator Cohen left the Senate, he gave a set of remarks in which he lamented things that were not going well in our politics. Inflammatory rhetoric, divisive, crazy people on the radio and television making things worse, instant polls, reacting to polls, people behaving in extreme and inflammatory ways. And he concluded by saying, the center has to hold, because if the center doesn't hold, we're going to have gridlock, we're going to have paralysis, we're going to have government shutdowns, and the cynicism is going to cripple the functioning of our government for generations. Okay, that was an entire generation ago. That was 20 years ago. And every single one of the things that he described, I would say, has gotten worse during that time.
It has.
And so I guess what I would start, since all of you have credibility on this issue, but I want to start with you, do you any longer believe that the center can hold? Is that a lost cause? And if it can, how does that happen?
I think in the short term, the center is not going to hold, but I think in the long term, it has to. Otherwise, I was actually quoting Yeats in terms of the second coming, and that things fall apart when the center can no longer hold, and the worst are full of passion, intensity, while the best are lacking in all conviction. You have that same sentiment today, and I would say there are three things in my mind that are the cause of the, intensification of the mood. One is globalization, the second is immigration, and the third is the democratization of information. If you take those three phenomena and all of the consequences that flow from those three things, then you can see that there has been a tremendous shift in terms of job opportunity, in terms of sense of identity, in terms of America being number one. When you see the playing field start to level out because now everyone has access to information. So there are, we could spend the evening talking about it, but I think those three factors are at the heart of what is pulling us apart right now and pulling us to extremes, both in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party.
But when you say in the long term it has to, okay, show me the scenario where that actually happens. Like what changes the trajectory that we're now on?
Well, I think we'll see the breakup of the two parties in the sense that there'll be the more extreme right wing, the Breitbart folks and Donald Trump. They will try, I think, to embrace the GOP, but I think the Republican Party will resist that, the Paul Ryans and others. So we're likely to see two versions of the GOP at least. Or one Breitbart, one GOP, then you'll have the Angus King kind of centrist, and then you'll have the Senator Snow and Senator Collins who represent the moderate Republicans who will drift closer to the independents, and then you'll have the Democratic Party left. Now, how does this all come back together? I think that once people see that the fracturing and the breakup of this two-party system in which there's a big tent for both parties, they'll have to come back to that, otherwise they will see what the consequences are for us domestically, internationally, where we are unable to make decisions and therefore our futures will be even further receding for our kids.
But before I ask the others to talk about this, let me just get a quick show of hands. How many of you actually agree with Senator Cohen that we are staring in the face of the breakup of the parties as we've known them? Raise your hand if you think we are. Okay, just one. Okay. All right, tell me why.
I think the elements that Bill has described can be referred to as the revolution through which we are now passing in the world. Technology, changes in commerce across national borders, the movement of people across borders. It's very common in human affairs to have uncertainty, fear, anxiety, upheaval, and violence in such revolutions. The Industrial Revolution began 250 years ago in England, and you had an almost identical situation. Machines replaced men. And there was widespread fear of high unemployment. So there was fear, there was anxiety, there was demagoguery, there was violence. But over the course of the several decades in which the revolution played out, productivity rose so dramatically that there was a general rise in the standard of living of the entire society. And the politics then sorted itself out. I believe the greatest challenge we face as a country now is to figure out a way to harness the benefits from the revolution through which we are passing, from which most of the people in this room benefit, and everybody on this stage benefits. But there are tens of millions of our fellow Americans who are victims of this revolution, not beneficiaries. We've had a spectacular increase in the amount of wealth created in the world. But increasingly, worldwide and in America, it is concentrated in a relatively few hands and not distributed throughout the whole society. And that's the fear and anxiety that's now being expressed in the Morden campaign. I believe what will change it is for we to devise effective policies that don't take us backward in time, don't build walls, continue to harness the great benefits from technological change and increased trade, but see to it that they are distributed throughout the whole society in the form of education and skill so that everyone feels that they're benefiting. And when you get a rising standard of living for everyone, then I think the politics sorts itself out. I think Bill is right in terms of some degree of political alignment, particularly within the Republican Party, depending on what happens in the election, who wins, who loses, by what margin, what consequences come from it. But I think in the end, the politics will follow what happens in this larger society. And meeting the demand of equal opportunity for all Americans is the greatest challenge that we face. I think we're up to it, but a serious national debate has to occur on how do we adjust to this, not by going backward, but by going forward in a way that distributes education, opportunity, skill throughout the whole society.
Senator Snow?
Yes, I don't disagree with Bill in the sense that there is certainly change occurring, you know, within the political parties, and most certainly, you know, within the Republican Party. And I think much of which has occurred due to the political realignment, where, you know, Republicans are now more dominant in the South and the West. And we've lost a lot of our moderate centrist support in the Northeast and the Midwest. It's now more, you know, where the Democrats predominate. So you're seeing that change that's been underway and certainly manifested itself.
There's no reversing that change, right?
Well, there's no reversing that change. But I think...
I mean, for a big chunk of the last few years, you guys were the entire moderate caucus of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I was... that's exactly right. I was described as a dinosaur. In fact, there was a New York Times cartoonist who showed me in a museum as part of an extinct species.
Was it a good likeness?
Huh? Well, not quite. I would have done a little bit better on that one. But I always said, and I'm sure Susan feels the same, I felt like a cast member on Survivor, giving many obstacles to overcome. Not sure I was welcomed as a member of the organization. But what has really changed and what contributed to my departure? Because it was obviously a very difficult decision. But I came to that realization that the polarization was not going to diminish in the short term. And when Bill refers to the center, absolutely right. You need a center, and I describe it as a sensible center. Tried to build that, Susan has, you know, within the Republican Party, Jock has, my husband, and governor, I mean, because it is important. It's also important in the American political system as well, and in the United States Congress. And what we were doing is neglecting the major issues that are so consequential to the average American that George just spoke to. And there's a major detachment between those who are governed and those who are being governed. And you know, as I travel across the country, I hear people's fears, you know, that this current culture is going to become part, you know, and become more permanent institutionalized, and that we will not be able to change it. And that's why when I left the Senate, I thought it was important to concentrate on those elements where we could change it. Because I think it's so important that we support, you know, senators like Susan, like Angus, reinforce what they're attempting to do working across the aisle and restoring the normalcy to the legislative process for the rank and file to get more involved in drafting the legislation, having a stake in the outcome, because that's not happening. The essence of public service is solving problems. That's what I learned in my first days in the state legislature. And, you know, and it's from that premise that we have to work and to support those individuals who are willing to work across the aisle.
Senator Collins, I want to ask you from this perspective. So we're hearing a little bit of, well, in the long term, things will get better for, you know, if we're able to distribute economic gains more widely, or people get, you know, the political puzzle pieces move around and resettle, and then we have a center. But talk about the next couple of years, because what you hear now, we're a couple weeks from the election, what you hear now is people talking about endless investigations. Is it as bleak as that sounds?
I'm going to give a more optimistic view than my colleagues. Otherwise, Angus and I can't bear to stay in the Senate, right? But I really believe that there is an opportunity here. Certainly, the forces that have been described make it more difficult for those of us who are in the center, and they're exacerbated by gerrymandering in the House, by the 24/7 news cycle, by people only getting their news from outlets that reinforce what they already believe. But Angus and I have seen the center work. In 2013, when government shut down, which was a tremendous failure by all who were in public office, I went to the Senate floor and outlined a plan for reopening government. And I put together a group of 7 Republicans, 6 Democrats, and Angus, and we met night and day to hammer out a framework that led to the reopening of government. So there are those in the Senate who very much want government to work. And the reason that I'm optimistic, and Angus and I were just talking about this earlier, is the members of that group, which I dubbed the Common Sense Coalition, have all come up to me and said, you know, we need to get together and look ahead at the new Congress. And our next president, whoever she or he may be, has an opportunity to select issues that are bipartisan in nature and chalk up some wins for the American people, and I would suggest 3. One is to concentrate on increasing biomedical research. That affects every American family. The Republican Congress has been leading the way in increasing the budget for the National Institutes of Health, and it matters to everybody, and it's a totally bipartisan issue. Second would be an initiative to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. It's not just in Maine, it's all across the country. And third is to tackle our tax code, to really embrace tax reform and the goals of a simpler, fairer, more pro-growth tax system. I think if our next president put out a platform to address those 3 issues right up front, that there would be bipartisan support for doing so.
I just want to ask you one thing about the Senate versus the House. The Senate is not the House. It's more like the House than it used to be, but it's not the House. It's easier to do what you're describing in the Senate. Can it happen in the House when you have a caucus, majority caucus, that half the time is threatening to depose the Speaker?
I never served in the House, so maybe Olympia or Bill would be better able to address that. But I think it can happen. I believe that if the next president actually reaches out in a bipartisan way to the members of the House and the Senate, George Bush used to have the joint leadership over to breakfast once a week. And President Obama has not done that. I think he would have been better served to have done that. And it's hard to demonize someone you've broken bread with. If an agenda that has bipartisan support were put out there that the public would support, there would be pressure on both parties to do what Olympia said, start solving problems and stop focusing on scoring partisan political points.
Senator King, you are an independent. you caucus with the Democrats, you vote like a Democrat, but nevertheless you keep a distance from that party and, of course, obviously from the Republicans. Why is that an important part of your political identity?
Because I see myself as having an opportunity to be a bridge builder. And I'm trying.
Do your colleagues see you that way, or do they see you as a Democrat with a different name, like Bernie Sanders?
Well, I think if you would judge it by being viewed with some level of distrust by both sides,
yes.
The answer is yes. But I want to go back to something that Bill said at the beginning. We're talking about division and polarization in the Congress. The reality is that our political system reflects the public, mm-hmm. and the public is polarized and divided. And one of the points that Bill made that I think is very important is what I call the balkanization of the news business. And the fact that, that's the key word. In my experience in public policy, if you can get broad agreement among a large group of people on the facts, the policy is pretty easy. But when you don't have agreement on the facts, when people are living in alternative worlds of just, you know, A plus B equals C, mm-hmm. you can't get anything done. You can never get agreement. And that's one of the issues that I think we have to grapple with. The other piece that makes this so difficult, and you mentioned the House, to me the most pernicious doctrine that's arisen in my adult life is the idea that compromise is a dirty word. And that you can lose your election because you're viewed as a compromiser or a problem solver. It's one thing to lose your election because you disagree with your constituents on abortion or immigration or the budget. That's one thing. But if trying to solve a problem in a bipartisan way itself will cost you your seat, which can happen in primaries, and I've had friends tell me this, that's really dangerous because then you can't do business. There's no human enterprise that can survive without some level of compromise. And that's the danger that I see. Now, the optimistic note, I agree with Susan. I've had a lot of colleagues in the last couple of months saying, we're sick of this. In the new Congress, we're going to find a better way. And there are probably 20, 25, I'd say, easily from both sides that want to do that. And that's where we've got to try to start. The House, you know, the House has to sort out its own issues. But if we can start to do some things on that basis, and we have from time to time, then I think we can get somewhere. Taking an agenda like the one that Susan outlined, that really does have broad bipartisan support, let's get some wins.
Given the fact that, you know, there's one way of looking at our economic situation and saying that we had a golden period after World War II, when we dominated the world, and our GDP was a third of the world's GDP, and we had advantages no one else had, and including women coming into the workforce, labor productivity, all sorts of good things happening, and now the rest of the world's rising up to meet us, and we're just not going to get back to what we used to have. Do you think that's true?
No, I don't. The part I disagree with is about the rest of the world rising up. There is a myth, I believe it's a myth, that the United States is in decline at home and abroad. I think just the opposite is true. I think we are overwhelmingly dominant militarily. There hasn't been a Third World War, and there's likely not to be one, primarily because of the overwhelming dominance of the American military power. Secondly, we have the moral high ground. We have a lot of problems in our country, and they've manifested themselves during this recent campaign, but we still are the most open, free, and just society in all of human history, the first and truest meritocracy in human history, and people look up to us around the world. So I don't, and one of the great strengths of democracy is that we discuss openly, vigorously, sometimes too much, our problems and our issues. And we tend to magnify the power of our rivals. Mm-hmm. Russia is in a state of terminal decline. It's a temporary thing they're going through now, but population, demographics, finances, too detailed to mention here, mean that when Putin first took office, he said his greatest fear was that for the first time in 300 years, Russia could slide into the second or third tier of nations. That's where they're heading. China has huge problems, far exceeding ours, most notably the lack, the absence of democracy, the rule of law, and an independent judiciary. We're going to be very dominant for as far into the future as human beings can see. And if we can solve our domestic issues, our economic problems, raise the standard of living, increase education and skill, I think our dominance will be even greater in the 21st century than it was in the 20th, because we are open to innovation, change. I want to make just
one more. Okay, you got me feeling good now.
Yeah, well, let me make one point. In the, we're in a... You wouldn't know it by the news. We're in a technological revolution. 91% of
Are you
all,
saying that my business is screwing some things up?
91% of all online searches in the world are conducted on American systems. 99% of all smartphones in the world operate on American-made operating systems. You can go down the list. 15 of the top 20 universities in the world are American. 9 of the top 10 business brands in the world are American. This notion of American decline is a myth. And people yearn around the world for strong and effective American leadership. And I think we're going to rise above our current problems if we can deal with these economic issues that we're embroiled in now.
Senator Snow. I want to ask you another near-term politics question. I did an interview the other day with Senator Schumer, who is going to be the Democratic leader, about this very question I asked you guys. Are we in for a terrible slog for the next couple of years? And he said, no. He said, the Republicans are going to do business with us. And I said, what is the evidence for that? And he said, here's what happened. 2010 and 2012, Tea Party was on the march. We were coming out of the Great Recession. Senator Mitchell talked about economic forces. People were high state of agitation, and the Republican incumbents were back on their heels. Some were losing their primaries. Now, 2014, 2016, they're winning their primaries, and they're going to come out of this election and say, enough, I want to get stuff done, and I'm going to cooperate. Is that realistic?
Well, certainly. I think it obviously it depends on the basis on which they've won. I mean, as you're focusing on the primary, and Senator Schumer is focusing on the primaries, and that's been true. I mean, I think we know from the polarization that's occurred in America, that has divided America. Now, I think, frankly, we should jettison the red and blue maps because it's so divisive in focusing on red states and blue states, and more importantly is to focus on the United States. And so... the incentive has been on the primaries, and that's why you've seen, you know, either amendments and positions, and certainly when I was in the Senate, and I'm sure Susan would agree, we're all positioned for the ideological base. If there's one thing that changed, was everything was reoriented towards the base of the political parties. And I remember one time I was on the floor of the Senate at the table where each side has, where you have a description of the vote being considered, and that's always interesting because the discrepancy in those descriptions, you'd hardly recognize you were voting on the same issue. But in any event, I was wondering why we're having this vote. And a member of my leadership said, well, this one's for the base. And I said, well, how many votes do we have for the base? And that was true on both sides. We're casting those votes for the base, and we have to move away from that. And hopefully that will be the case. Because we really have to support those individuals who are willing to work across the aisle. The late Senator Warren Rudman, who was a former colleague of George and Bill's and a friend, you know, said, you know, politics is too important to be left to the politician. And he's so right. It is up to all of us to change the dynamic and the orientation, because that's what matters in America. I'm certainly hopeful, because I know we can change it if we all do it and weigh in. And that's what needs to happen, certainly in the United States Congress, to achieve the things that George was just referring to, you know, on the economic issues that matter profoundly to Americans. When I was describing a scenario based on a Main Street tour that I took here in Maine back in 2010, which I'd like to do, and we had a hearing, and the Secretary of Treasury was before the committee, and I described, you know, what I saw you know, for the economy, that it wasn't working for the communities in my state. And he said, oh, you're describing something very dark and pessimistic. I don't agree with you. Well, that was 6 years ago, and here we are. We're at 2% growth. That's not good enough for America, frankly. We can do better with the investments that George is referring to and Susan's talking about for an agenda, and we have to focus on that. People often ask me, you know, is it really that different from the past? And I said, well, yeah, it's as different as night from day in the sense that what distinguished us from the past is that in the past we were willing, after the fierce debates, and many of them were unpleasant, that we were able to transcend our differences for the greater good of the country and reach a solution. Today, it's all about taking it to the next election and, you know, scoring political points, the all-or-nothing proposition. So it doesn't become legislating anymore. It's all about, you know, campaigns. And so it becomes perpetual. We used to, you know, and George and Bill can attest to this, when we first, you know, I was in the House and they're in the Senate, is that at least in the first year, you could devote your time to a legislative agenda, you know, knowing that in the second year, politics would interfere. So hopefully, you know, when you have people like Susan and Angus who are there, we have to support them. We have to speak up and support those who are willing to take the risk of working with each other instead of against each other. As somebody once said, bipartisanship is not a political theory. It is a political necessity.
Senator Collins, do you think that they're more jealous of you for still being in, or you're more jealous of them for being out?
I think that all three of my colleagues did such fabulous jobs representing the state of Maine that I, for one, am very pleased to try to follow in their footsteps. I remain, to answer your question about Senator Schumer, there's a real incentive for the Democrats to cooperate, because this cycle, there are far more Republicans who, as you know, are up for re-election. It is the reverse 2 years from now. And they are going to want to be able to point to a list of accomplishments. And I think that creates an opening, an opportunity for us to come together and get something done. But I want to piggyback on something that Olympia said, and that is that those of us who do cross the aisle and work together to try to really solve problems need the support of the American people. If in primaries the activists tend to be from the far left in the Democratic Party and the far right in the Republican Party, it makes it very difficult for those who are in the middle, particularly since independents can't vote in primaries for the most part. So I believe that the center in America needs to wake up and be more active and not lead the political decisions to the extremes.
Senator King, we've been talking about what doesn't work, and of course the entire campaign's been focused on what doesn't work in Washington, and that's fairly evident. You've been in the Senate now 3 years, 4 years? Tell me a story about something where you found that it did work, that where you saw a problem, you were able to work with colleagues of the other party, and achieve a success that you were proud of.
A perfect example of that was I'd been there about 6 months, and one of the things that surprised me, the sequester hit in March of my first year, and everybody in the place was wringing their hands and saying how terrible it was. And the Democrats had a plan. They were in the majority then. They put it on the floor. It failed. The Republicans had a plan. It went on the floor. It failed. And I was, at that point, I said, well, this is where Mitch and Harry make a deal. And it didn't happen. Everybody just moved on to the next issue, which really shocked me. One of my theories is that the Senate, here's an interesting fact, 65 of the 100 senators have been there 8 years or less. And what that means is two-thirds of the Senate has never seen it work. They're like a high school football team that's lost every game for 5 years. We don't know how to win. And so subsequent to that sequester debacle, there came the law was that student loan rates were going to double in the summer of 2013. The same thing happened. The Democrats had a plan. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders didn't go, didn't get the votes. The Republicans had a plan, didn't get the votes. Joe Manchin and I, he's a very conservative Democratic senator from West Virginia, said, this is dumb. There's got to be a solution. This is just arithmetic. Come on. So we started talking to Richard Burr, who's a Republican senator from North Carolina, Tom Coburn, very Republican senator from Oklahoma, and Lamar Alexander, who's one of the giants of the Senate, in my estimation, and then Tom Carper and a couple of Dick Durbin, and there were four or five of us, and we got together and hammered out a compromise on student loans. And Durbin got the president, and the president, we had this kabuki meeting at the White House, where, you know, I thought, oh, this is going to be a great discussion with the president. It was actually a setup for the president to tell Tom Harkin, the chairman of the committee and a very liberal guy, you got to take this deal. And Harkin said, oh, yeah, okay. And he took the deal. It ended up passing both houses, signed by the president. And I just saw something a couple of weeks ago. That change, which had the effect of cutting student loan rates in half, has saved American students $50 billion. So that was a case where just a small group said, this is dumb, there's got to be a way to solve this problem. Now, that was a fairly distinct, narrow problem. You talk about immigration or the whole budget, it becomes much more complex. But it can be done, and I think it's important to note, Congress doesn't do well on the big issues right now, no doubt about it, immigration or guns or budgets. But there is a level of education reform, workforce reform, VA reform. All of those passed by strong 70, 80 bipartisan votes. They all went through the House. They all went to the president. So that doesn't get the press. I'm still waiting for the headline that says 8,500 airplanes landed safely yesterday. You know, you never see that. So that was a case where I felt there was a contribution to be made from the center, and those things can happen. I want to ask Bill Cohen a question about the structure. Bill, when you guys were there, did you have a partisan lunch every day of the week?
We had a partisan lunch once a week.
Yeah, now it's every day of the week for both parties. Yeah. That's one of the problems.
Wait, I thought it was only on Tuesdays.
No, Wednesday.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And the Senate prayer breakfast on Wednesday morning is the only bipartisan event of the week.
Can I raise a point of order? I think the junior senators had much too much time allotted. I mean, some deference has to be shown to seniority here.
Well, okay, Mr. Secretary, let me do it this way.
It's okay. Go ahead and ask him a question.
He told a story in the green room about you throwing your weight around as the senior guy on veterans, military defense issues, and sort of crowding him out of a speech he wanted to give at a ship opening.
That's true.
I know that the relationships among colleagues in the Senate of the same state is often kind of difficult. What's the worst thing he ever did to you when you guys were in the
become majority leader. Took away my prime position to go first on each and every occasion. I'd like to say just a couple of points in terms of what's being discussed here. I don't think that the two leaders can really be in a position to make deals unless you have leadership coming from the White House. I think who is in the White House sets a tone. It's just a personal opinion on this, and it may be not shared by anyone else. Secondly, there's the issue of we haven't talked a word about foreign policy and how that impacts our national security, our economic security. And people around the world, notwithstanding what George has mentioned, and it's true, we're still the best deal on the planet. Everybody still wants to invest here because of the rule of law as opposed to the law of rule. But other countries are really getting concerned about us. They see us as pulling back and disengaging. Now think about this. We had to pass, or you had to pass, Susan and Angus, a budget with a $3.2 or $3 billion, the European Reassurance Initiative. We had to pass over $3 billion to reassure our European allies that we're with them, that we haven't abandoned our commitment to Europe and to its security. So you look at that, you look at what's taking place in the Middle East, we're seen as pulling back, and then you turn and look at the Asia-Pacific region. It's an economic powerhouse in that region, that's China. India is coming up behind it, and it will take some time, but China is going to pose a significant threat in the sense of competition, certainly economically and ultimately militarily at some point. So other countries watch us. We haven't talked about Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has been dismissed by virtually everybody in office, except it has a national security dimension to it. It's not just the economic arrangement that you have 12 countries who've agreed with the 11 other countries with the United States to have this Trans-Pacific Partnership in terms of lowering tariff barriers and regulations. They see it as part also of the United States being in the lead in writing the economic rules for that part of the world. And what we have seen is President Obama said, you know, we want to go forward with this, and Congress is saying, no, it's out of the question. So virtually every one of the Asia-Pacific countries now look at us and say, wait a minute, if you don't write the rules, guess who's going to write the rules? And is this in your interest? And the answer is no. And yet, most of the American people see this, well, it's a trade agreement. Trade is bad. It's not that trade has been bad for our workers. Technology has also had its major role, namely that, as George was talking about the Industrial Revolution, machines started replacing labor. Well, technology is replacing labor. And so we've got to think about ways in which we stay engaged in world affairs economically, diplomatically, and militarily. And I would not challenge the issue at all. I agree with Senator Mitchell George, my junior colleague. We have the best in the world. And everyone here, Angus, you're in the Armed Services, Susan, you were there, Olympia. We have the best military in the world. But we do stupid things in terms of passing sequesters, which means across-the-board cuts. That has been devastating in terms of trying to plan for anything in the future. And if I had one message that we need to come to grips with is we have to have a budget. You can't continue to run our government on a continuing resolution. Right now, the funding is good until when? December?
December 9th.
And then there's no budget. How do you, in the military or as a military contractor, building aircraft or submarines or naval ships, how do they plan? And how does the military plan when there's no budget?
And we've gotten to a point where passing a continuing resolution is considered a big success.
Right. So these are things that we need to do, and we have to really begin at home. We can't really be strong abroad unless we're strong at home. And other countries look to us. I can verify this to you. They look to us and say, I go there and I say, I want you to be like Mike. And they say, we don't want to be like Mike, because Mike can't make a decision. Mike is not making decisions. You are paralyzed into inaction when it comes to the big issues, and we're not facing the big issues. So I think it takes a combination, strong leadership at the top, allowing the members, the leaders of our two parties at that point to have more room to negotiate and come, and sort of like the marriage, moving, as Frost said, moving easy in harness. You've got to have the harness.
I want to close with an easy question for you guys that you might actually like to talk about a little bit, and that is the contribution of my business, the media, to the situation that we're in. And it's interesting,
we have.
As a consequence of both the kind of vitriolic, polarized environment we're in and a consequence of being on television, I've had the experience that I didn't have for the vast majority of my career of getting written about from time to time or talked about in the media. And son of a gun, sometimes they say stuff that's not true. So that was a shock to me. And so I would just like to ask any of you who want to answer,
to tell me a story about what you think is wrong with the media. You were rubbing your hands over there.
I was. I'd be happy to go first. The only question is, how much time do we have, right? First, let me say I have great respect for you, and I know that you're fair, and I know that you've been subjected to a lot of criticism as well. But I think there's a real problem in this country that has contributed to the polarization and the hyper-partisanship, and that is that we have media outlets, both traditional cable outlets and social media outlets, that seek to inflame the partisanship on both sides. When I was growing up, we had three networks, plus what we called ETV, which became PBS, and we had newspapers that were much stronger than they are today, and we all had a common sense of what was going on. And now people tend to get their news, as I said earlier, from outlets that just reinforce what they already think, that don't challenge them with alternative viewpoints or stories about what happened that they may not even know about. And I think that is so corrosive to the social fabric of this country, and that it is driving us apart and making those of us who are honored to serve in Congress cater more to those extremes.
Now, it's a little bit like what Senator King said about the leadership versus, polarization within the parties versus within the electorate. Is it a supply-side thing that the media is driving, or is it something that the information revolution and the desires of the public is driving?
I think it's an inevitable result of the, as I think George used the term, the democratization of the media with a small d. The multiplicity of sources. I learned a new term, maybe everybody's heard it before, confirmation bias. And it's a human tendency to seek out confirmation of our own views. And so if you're conservative, you watch Fox News or you read Breitbart. If you're liberal, you watch MSNBC and read Daily Kos. And the problem is, as I said at the beginning, if people don't have a common understanding of the facts of whatever the situation is, whether it's healthcare or immigration, how many immigrants are there coming into the United States? What is the situation at the Texas border factually? And the problem is the media, and I don't think you can blame it on the media or the mainstream media. It's a function of this. It's a side effect of this absolutely multiplicity of outlets that can, you remember the term we all grew up with was broadcast. Mm-hmm. And we all got our facts from the same person, Walter Cronkite. Now the term is narrowcast. And you can cast, we're going into an era where even the TV and cable is going to be made obsolete by streaming. People are going to have very narrow sources of information. I think it's very dangerous. I don't know what the solution to it is. Certainly the solution isn't for government to somehow put its heavy hand on it. But it's a very much a part of what we're doing right now.
Let me ask Senator Mitchell and Secretary Cohen, His Highness.
you can say Mayor.
Yeah.
Mayor, right. Mayor Cohen.
about something broader than that, not just the niche outlets, but was there ever an issue when you were the leader, for example, where you thought the press as a whole just got it totally wrong?
The press as a whole is a tough thing to define in a single moment.
When you were the leader, we didn't have quite as much of the niche media as we used to, but I mean the interpretation of a set of events, of a piece of legislation you stopped or passed, where you thought the
media simply distorted, got it wrong?
Not the press as a whole. Mm-hmm. There were many, many occasions in which a press outlet, a newspaper, mm-hmm. or some other entity, for obvious partisan reasons, presented the issue in a way that was so extreme that it distorted the reality. But I don't
that
think...
That you felt was deliberate distortion or not?
Oh, yeah.
Not
oh, deliberate? Sure, yeah. Yeah. I think that's the case. Well, deliberate, if you ask them, it would be deliberately exposing the truth. That would be their defense, but it wasn't the case. You also have to remember that the cable news outlets, the number of them, and the manner in which they operate is quite a recent phenomenon. It did not exist in that form in the time when I was Senate Majority Leader. It was in its early stages. You had CNN, but you didn't have what you have today. Mm-hmm. And I think there's another factor that the cable news networks represent that builds on the point that Angus and Susan made. For the first time, if a political figure makes a mistake, it is not simply reported and printed. It is repeated thousands and thousands of times. And the fact of the matter is, it is a harsh reality of human nature. Even the most gross lie, if repeated often enough to a mass audience, will be accepted as the truth. And so I think one of the dangers is of this polarization of the cable networks, the 24-hour news cycle with an incessant demand for something new. Everything is now labeled breaking news. I'm waiting for the day to wake up and say, breaking news, the sun rose this morning.
Yeah. It breaks all day long, too. It's breaking at 10 o'clock. It's still breaking at 7 in the night.
I heard Ted Turner was quoted as saying the worst thing he ever did was invent CNN. Yeah. I can't vouch for that, but it's an interesting observation.
Yeah. Well, my point is that it's this seeking the sensational. I don't want to defend Donald Trump here, mm-hmm. but... there were 17 Republican candidates, and at one point they had 12 of them on the stage at the same time, and they had 30 seconds to answer. It's an invitation to slogans, an invitation to inflammatory statements. A person who tried to get up and talk in a serious, nuanced way about a complex problem, couldn't get airtime, wouldn't be on the national news, would make page 32, paragraph 50 of the story. And so the media, what the effect is, perhaps not the intention, is to reduce the seriousness of the debate, to oversimplify every issue, to invite inflammatory, complex statements. That's what's happened in this campaign.
Let me ask you to make a closing observation as an astute observer of human nature, literary figure, all that sort of thing. General level of character of people in politics, people in the media.
Boy, that's a close call. Now, let me say a few words about what's happened in the media. To pick up on what George and Susan, Olympia and Angus have just said, today we have kind of three things in the media. Speed, get it first, superficiality, and sensationalism. Those three things dominate the media today. When I was at the Pentagon, That's spelled Twitter, which is the Twitter world of 140 characters. What is taking place in our society today is everything is being reduced in time and space and speed. And so I go back to quoting, T.S. Eliot. Where is the knowledge we've lost in information? Where's the wisdom we've lost in knowledge? And so what's happened is that we have more information available to us than at any time in the history of mankind, all the world over, more information. We have information, but we don't necessarily have knowledge. So the information is, we just click it on here. I can get it very quick and very superficial. We don't drill down to get the substance of the knowledge because we don't have to. So we have information, we don't necessarily have knowledge, but even when we have knowledge, we don't necessarily have wisdom or wise decisions. So really what is taking place in our world, the media is not at fault, it is complicit in it because it's in the business. It has to make a profit. It has to draw eyeballs in terms of whether it's television or readership in print. And so the pressure is on to get it out and get it fast. And when I was at the Pentagon, we had one reporter say, look, my network told me, get it out, even if it's inaccurate, get it out and we'll be on first, we can correct it later. And so we're constantly dealing with that sort of element in our society. I saw a man destroyed, John Tower, through the press, in terms of everyone was feeding on the fact John Tower should never be confirmed as Secretary of Defense. He had alleged drinking problems or he's a womanizer. And all of the allegations started coming in over the transom. And there was a front page story that John Tower was seen getting off a plane in Texas, and he sort of stumbled and looked like he might be under the influence, and then he had inappropriately touched a young officer, the officer enlisted. Senator McCain and I found out, when he called the base commander, found out totally false story. In fact, that individual was released from the military because of some mental problems at that time. So McCain and I went rushing up to the press gallery in the Senate. It was packed, and we made an opening statement and said, this story running in the Washington Post is without any solid foundation. In fact, the person who made the statement has been released from the military because of exaggerations and also some questionable mental stability. The first question that came up from the press corps that day was not, gee, we got it wrong. Do you realize that you two senators have just violated that individual's right of privacy? And so we said, wow, here you are destroying a man through these allegations which are not true, and yet when we defend it, you're saying we violated somebody else's right of privacy. So that was an element that was in place back in the 90s.
You think what happened at Tower was flat out unjust?
I do.
Absolutely. Do you agree with that?
No.
Well, we disagree.
I think we're running out of time, and I want to say one more thing. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to say one more thing. Mayor of the city of Bangor can say just a couple of words. I'd like to say something about the panel members, excluding Senator Mitchell for a moment. But I was the beneficiary of having people work for me and help me when I was a young candidate. Olympia Snow volunteered to help me out when I was first starting out, and her husband, Jock McKernan, and Governor McKernan, were there pounding on doors, helping me to get elected. Susan Collins was a young college student. She was up in northern Maine, helping to advance one of my walks through the state.
This is when you had those huge blisters
on
your feet?
I had the huge blisters, but Susan Collins was up there helping me out. Her husband, who is here, Tom Daffron, was my chief of staff. Susan's staff is here tonight too, the Woodcock family and the so-called Collins teams all here. We could not have done, I could not have without their help, but they represented something that Angus King has followed up with and that Senator Mitchell reflects. And I'll give you one final story, what is really important to me. During 1995, I think it was, I supported Bill Clinton's bill dealing with more policemen on the beat. And a constituent came into my Portland office and mad and was raising a lot of cane with this young receptionist. She said, what's the problem? She said, your senator, he's too damn reasonable. And I thought, that's gonna be on the epitaph, too damn reasonable. But that really, we're coming full circle. That's what represents, I think, what the people of Maine really insist upon. When you look at Senator Mitchell, who was a partisan Democrat in the best sense of the word. He advocated Democratic principles and the values of the party, and he did it in a way that was so reasonably argued that Republicans were infuriated most of the time. And with Olympia and Susan and Angus, the one word you pick out, say these are reasonable people who want to sit down and reason with the Maine people or the American public. And I must tell you, that's the benefit of coming from a small state. But all of us up on the stage, I think we know almost everybody here, or have met almost everyone here. And we feel a personal connection to you. And you have entrusted us over the years with your confidence, even though you might disagree with us on any given vote. You think we've been reasonable and responsible. So I want to say that we may never be together again on one stage, and I just want to say that
that's kind of how a proud. Sad thought.
No, well,
but now you see why I ran for Senate Majority Leader.
And now you see why I got the last word.
let me just say, as we close, I would offer. I'm not from Maine, but I would offer my wish as a citizen, and that is more of what we've seen on this platform tonight, and less of what we've been getting. So, thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speakers were Maine's five living senators. William Cohen, George Mitchell, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, and Angus King. If you missed all or part of today's Speaking in Maine, visit our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.